Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Unquiet Grave, The FBI and the Struggle for the Soul of Indian Country by Steve Hendricks. Narrated by Charles Constant. The utmost good faith shall always be observed towards the Indians. Their land and property shall never be taken from them without their consent, and in their property, rights, and liberty they shall never be invaded or disturbed, unless in just and lawful wars authorized by Congress. Northwest Ordinance of 1789. A note to the listener. To keep this book to a reasonable length, I have condemned a mass of detail to the end notes. Listeners interested in my choices about what to put in the end notes and what to put in the book proper, as well as choices about diction and style, may want to listen to the About the Book section before starting on the main text. Most listeners will miss little by going straight to Chapter 1. Then. Chapter 1. As the FBI told the story, it happened like this. On February 24th, at 2:45 in the afternoon, a rancher on that part of the South Dakota steppe that crumbles into the Badlands was looking for a place to run a fence line when he turned a bend in a gully and found, curled on its left side, clothed in a maroon jacket and blue jeans, and looking for all the world like someone sleeping in perfect peace, a corpse. Its place of rest was the bottom of an embankment 20 feet high and not 50 steps from Highway 73. But hidden from the road by the embankment. The nearest settlement lay 10 miles to the southwest, at a smattering of chipboard federal houses called Wanbley. A few miles to the north, the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, on which the corpse rested, petered out into one of continental America's emptier expanses. The body lay, if not in the precise middle of nowhere, hard on the edge of it. Roger Amiot did not approach the body. He returned to his truck, drove the mile back to his house, and called the Bureau of Indian Affairs Police in Kyle, the next outpost past Wanbley. The police had an officer at his place in 20 minutes. The officer was followed by deputy sheriffs from Kadoka, the county seat, then by 2 BIA investigators and a special agent of the Federal Bureau of Investigation from the town of Pine Ridge, the reservation capital 90 miles off. A search of the scene showed no sign of crime. No violence to the body, no bullet casings or gunpowder, no scuff marks in the scrub, nothing so much as a footprint. A few tufts of dark hair clung to the face of the blonde embankment, suggesting the unfortunate had fallen over it. When they were hauling the body off, Amiot would later say, one of the cops said, I thought it was pretty tactless, he said, well, I guess there must not have been a rape involved, her pants are still on. Her pants. That was my first clue she was a woman. I didn't get too close, and you couldn't tell one way or the other from a distance. She had no identification on her. As the sun fell, Jane Doe was loaded into an ambulance and driven to the Indian Health Service Hospital in Pine Ridge, where next afternoon an autopsy was performed. The pathologist judged her an Indian of 20 to 25 years. 5 feet 2 inches, 110 pounds, and a light complexion, though dehydration and exposure had darkened her. She had borne a child or children and had surrendered a gallbladder to a surgeon and, near to death, had had sexual intercourse of a voluntary nature. She had died, the pathologist eventually said. The precise moment of his saying so is a matter of some importance and uncertainty, of frostbite, and had lain in the elements for 7 to 10 days. Her decay was so severe that her fingerprints could not be taken at the hospital, so the FBI asked that her hands be chopped off and forwarded to its laboratory in Washington. The doctor amputated them, and they were sent east. While the lab worked, the authorities on Pine Ridge tried to identify the woman, but none of their leads proved fruitful. Her decomposition worsening, she was moved to a mortuary, but the body proved too far gone to preserve. On March 2, 1976, a week after her discovery, Jane Doe was given a Catholic service and a pauper's burial in an unmarked grave by order of the BIA police. The next afternoon, the FBI Identification Division in Washington called the FBI field office in Rapid City, which oversaw operations on Pine Ridge. It was Ash Wednesday, the day on which believers since the Middle Ages have darkened their foreheads in reminder of the approach of Judgment Day. Washington told Rapid City that the lab had lifted prints from the woman's severed hands, and the Identification Division had matched them to Anna Mae Aquash, a federal fugitive and luminary in the American Indian Movement. It took 2 days to find her family in the Canadian Maritimes. Aquash was a Mi'kmaq tribeswoman, a Nova Scotian by birth, at which point the press was also notified. That was the FBI's story. Neither the family of Anna Mae Aquash nor her colleagues in AIM believed she had died of exposure. The Aquash they knew was too smart to have taken an underdressed stroll in the prairie winter, and even if she had, she was too strong a backpacker and too shrewd an improviser to have succumbed to the cold. And she never, never traveled alone on Pine Ridge, which was then in a state of anarchy just shy of civil war. Her friends and family thought it as likely she had died of exposure, alone on Pine Ridge, as of a paper cut. They wanted her body unearthed and a second autopsy performed. The government beat them to it. On March 9th, 6 days after Aquash was identified, the FBI asked for, and a federal judge ordered, a post-mortem. 2 days later, a backhoe was sent to Holy Rosary Cemetery, outside the town of Pine Ridge, and the grave dug up. Candy Hamilton, a friend of Aquash's, stood vigil. "After I got there," Hamilton said years later, "Dave Price and Bill Wood and Gary Adams showed up. They were about the worst of the FBI agents on the reservation, though they did sort of keep their distance from me that morning. I had always sworn no matter what they did, they were never going to see me cry. But I'd already gotten started before they got there. I heard one of them say, 'Well, she's crying.' It wasn't a sympathetic tone. They were making jokes and laughing and all that over there." Special Agent Wood eventually introduced himself to Hamilton. She said she knew who he was. He asked if she had information about how Aquash had died. She told him to go to hell. In half an hour, the pine vault holding Aquash was lifted from the ground, loaded onto a flatbed truck, and driven to the hospital. There waited Dr. Gary Peterson, deputy medical examiner for Greater Minneapolis. Peterson had been hastily retained by the Wounded Knee Legal Defense Offense Committee, AIM's legal arm. When the FBI had announced it would hire a pathologist to re-autopsy Aquash, WKLDOC, Wickledoc, had asked that Dr. Peterson be allowed to observe. The government's men had replied that they wanted to get started immediately, but out of kindness, they would wait a day for the family's observer. But that morning at the hospital, the FBI agents told Dr. Peterson their doctor was not coming. They did not say why. They said only that if a second necropsy were to be had, Peterson would have to do it. Peterson had brought none of his tools, and the hospital was ill-equipped. The original autopsy on Aquash, like all Pine Ridge autopsies, was the work of a pathologist who came from off the reservation, kit in tow. Peterson asked the staff to gather what equipment they could and sent Special Agent Price to Sioux Nation, the general store in Pine Ridge, to fetch a butcher knife. A clutch of Aquash's friends, women chiefly, marked time outside the autopsy room. I thought, "Oh shoot, these agents are having it much too easy today because we're all so upset," Candy Hamilton recalled. "So I started quarreling with Wood. I said, 'Her family's coming, and we want her jewelry and personal items to give to them.' He said, 'Well, that's all evidence now. You can't have any of that.' I said, 'That's not evidence. You couldn't even identify her by 'em. We want it.' He just sneered and walked out." Hamilton is a squat woman with a voice metered in the Cumberlands and a chin that comes at you like a shovel. She was one of many white do-gooders who came to Pine Ridge in the 1970s for the cause of Indian rights, and one of the few who stayed after the moment expired. She divided her time between freelance reporting and volunteering for Wickledoc. "Well, Wood came back in and was way across the room from me, and he said, Candy, you want something of anime's? Here. And he threw a box across the room at me. Take her hands. I caught it, and all the women turned and looked and said, "What's that?" And I said, "He says it's her hands." You could hear them rattling in there. Everybody was horrified. They hadn't started the autopsy yet, so I went in the room where Peterson was. They still had her all covered up. I told him, "It's really important for her to have all her body together. Could you put these in with her? Or put them back on her or something?" And he did. He sewed them back on at the end of the autopsy. When Dr. Peterson's tools were at last assembled, he unsealed the pine vault and, with the help of Agents Wood and Adams, removed the cloth-covered coffin inside. The coffin was opened and the body, wrapped in plastic and cloth, was extracted and unwrapped. It was coated in a disinfectant of such pungency that Agent Adams had to excuse himself and revisit his breakfast. No sooner had Peterson brushed the disinfectant from Aquash than he noticed a lump in her left temple, just above the eye. It looked and felt like a bullet. He suspended his examination while a radiologist took the body for x-rays, which confirmed that the lump was a metal object the size and shape of a slug. The body was returned to Peterson, and in seconds he found a hole at the base of the skull. It was surrounded by a circle of dried blood and gunpowder 2 inches in diameter. "You could not believe it," he would later say. "I mean, the hole was so plain in the back of her neck. And in the front, you could feel the lump. You could see the bullet from across the street." Even before he opened her skull, Dr. Peterson concluded that Anime Aquash had died of a different kind of exposure. As it turned out, exposure to a .32-caliber copper-jacketed bullet. It fell to Norman Zagrossi to explain how the government had missed a bullet in the head of a corpse and failed to recognize in her a fugitive whom federal officers had not only arrested more than once, but were also searching for at the time her body was found. Zagrossi was the assistant special agent in charge of the FBI's Rapid City Resident Agency, which meant he ran the office. A sad-eyed man of languid posture but fleet speech, he would soon become infamous in Indian country for saying of its occupants, "They're a conquered nation, and when you're conquered, the people you're conquered by dictate your future." He called his agents, not inaccurately, a colonial police force. Zagrossi saw no mischief in the first autopsy. He said a small-caliber head wound could cause almost no bleeding and could be nearly undetectable once a body had begun to decompose. In proof thereof, he said that no one, none of the paramedics or nurses or doctors or lawmen who had seen the body, had detected the least sign of injury. As for the FBI's not recognizing Aquash, no agents had been at the autopsy, and the lone agent who saw Aquash at Amiot's ranch did not identify her for the good reason that he had never seen a picture of her. The newspapers of Western Dakota, in the manner of the provincial press everywhere, printed Zagrossi's claims without corroboration, and returned to alfalfa futures and car dealership openings. A few less tractable observers, all from beyond Dakota, nosed further. Freelancer Kevin McKiernan, whose reporting on Pine Ridge remains a gift to history, found a nurse by the name of Inez Hodges who had been on duty the night Aquash was brought to the hospital. Hodges had seen the Jane Doe in the morgue and had instantly noticed an odd and obvious mark on the woman's eye socket, the large bullet, although she did not diagnose it as such. She also saw a swath of blood on the white plastic sheet beneath the woman's head. Its plain source was a raised crater at the base of the skull. Hodges showed her findings to a co-worker, whose name the FBI knows but to this day will not release. To do so, says the FBI, would violate the witness's privacy. Kevin McKiernan also found Dr. Stephen Shanker, who had pronounced Aquash dead on arrival. Shanker was just out of medical school, and his experience in matters post-mortem was elementary. Nonetheless, in the first moments of his exam, he noticed that the hair on the back of Aquash's head was matted with dried blood. He put his hand there and got a palmful of blood, apparently freshly thawed. A moment's probing brought him to the bullet hole. His analysis was unequivocal. She hadn't died of natural causes, It looked like a police matter, and he assumed the autopsy the next day would analyze the wound more extensively. Both Shanker and Hodges said they were stunned by the exposure ruling, and that after the bullet was finally found, they expected authorities to interview them about what they had seen. The authorities did not, at least not until a public outcry was raised months later. McKiernan and other reporters also spoke with Dr. W. O. Brown, the resident pathologist at West Nebraska General Hospital in Scotts Bluff, and the contract coroner for the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Two or three dozen times a year, Dr. Brown flew his private plane to Pine Ridge to look over a corpse, or more nearly, to overlook one. Of his work on Aquash, he was unrepentant. "A little bullet isn't hard to overlook," he said. "It certainly isn't the first time a bullet was overlooked. And why all the interest in this case? It seems awfully routine, you know. So they found an Indian body. So a body was found. And I suppose the Indians will never let that woman die. Ames trying to stir up all the trouble they can. It's a matter of record that Indians use every little incident that they can to create a situation over. They distort facts and use it to their advantage to further their cause. But I've tried to remain neutral. I don't think I'm prejudiced." The day after Dr. Peterson found the bullet, Dr. Brown was sure of this much. He had missed it only because the hospital's X-ray machine had been broken. But he soon reversed course. The machine had been in fine fettle, and he had merely chosen not to use it because X-rays were too time-consuming, too awkward, and at times unsuccessful. And anyway, since it's fairly common for Indians like these to die of an overdose, why bother X-raying them? His tests showed that Aquash's blood was free of drugs or alcohol. When other excuses failed him, he said he had cut short his exam because the body was stinky and decomposed, conditions one might have thought were as routine in his work as soot in a chimney sweep's. But from his verdict, he did not swerve. It was the frost that had taken Anime Aquash, not the bullet. The bullet, he said, may have pierced the brain casing, but not the brain proper. If it had entered the casing, it might have started a chain of events that incapacitated Aquash and left her at the mercy of the cold, but the shot did not kill her. A lesser faith might have been shaken by having missed, progressively, the stained sheet beneath Aquash's head, her gun-powdered and bloodied hair, the hole through several layers of bone, the bloodied masses of soft tissue, including the brain through which the bullet had in fact passed and which Brown had removed and examined before dumping it in Aquash's chest with other dissected organs, and finally the bullet itself. But Brown's faith was hardened by a steady diet of errata. Among other errors in the autopsy, he claimed to have dissected and measured Aquash's stomach, one of her kidneys, and her adrenal glands. But Dr. Peterson found all of these organs attached, unopened, and with metrics quite different from Brown's. And although Dr. Brown reported that Aquash had not been raped and had been dead no more than 10 days, Peterson concluded that rape could not be ruled out, and Aquash could have been killed weeks, even months, before she was found. Whether these other errors argued that Brown had missed the bullet purposely or incompetently was anyone's guess. The FBI was in a better position to guess than most. Although Norm Zagrosi said none of his men had been at the autopsy, a nurse who helped with the autopsy told reporters that she had given Aquash's amputated hands to Agent David Price. A BIA investigator at the autopsy, Nathan Merrick, said he thought two FBI agents had been there, one of whom was Price. Dr. Brown said on one occasion that a couple of agents may have been at the autopsy, and on another that agents had wandered in and out of the procedure. The doctor finally settled on the position that no agents had been there at any time. It is this position that the FBI has taken before Congress and other inquirers ever since. It's not true. FBI reports released under the Freedom of Information Act would eventually prove that four agents, Price, Wood, Donald Dealing, and John Muniz, were in the autopsy room, some just before and some just after the procedure. Price even photographed Aquash's face. Zagrosi had either lied or been lied to about his agent's presence. In the 1980s, we had the pleasure of deposing David Price, Ken Tilson, the senior-most lawyer of Wickledock, would later say. Price, to my mind, must be the most evil living agent in an organization that trained thousands of agents in the practice of evil. When we asked him whether he was at the autopsy, his answer was, "I wasn't there." "Okay, then. Why did the doctor's assistant say she gave you the hands?" "Well, I was outside the room." "I see. Was there a window in the door?" "Yeah." "Did you look through the window?" "I may have." "But you weren't at the autopsy?" "Oh, no. No, no, no." Asked what he remembered in 2003, Norman Zagrosi said, "I know all about the first autopsy. I'll never forget it. Now I can tell you which of our agents were there, and that was Price and Woods." He meant Wood. Was he saying that Price and Wood were in the room while Braun was working on Aquash? That's correct. Zagrosi was unaware he was making a confession. He seemed merely to have forgotten his original story and was now saying what he remembered, which, unfortunately for his credibility, was the truth. As at the autopsy, so at the crime scene. Zagrosi said only one FBI agent, eventually named as Donald Dealing, had gone to Roger Amiot's ranch, but witnesses counted four agents. Amiot remembered Price and Wood by name. A BIA officer also remembered Price, yet the officer's boss, BIA Police Chief Ken Sayers, tried to claim the officer was not there. Sayers said only three BIA policemen went to the scene, but witnesses counted as many as six, including Sayers, who in turn denied he had been at Amiot's. When we asked Price whether he was at the crime scene, Wickledock's Ken Tilson said, his first thing was, "I wasn't assigned to her." "Okay. Were you there?" "I wasn't working that day." That wasn't the question. Were you there? "I don't remember." Months after the body was found and after much harrying by Kevin McKiernan, Zagrosi said that while only Agent Dealing had gone to Amiot's ranch on assignment, others might have gone out of curiosity. To go to Amiot's out of curiosity meant making a 3-hour round trip from either the town of Pine Ridge or Rapid City where agents were stationed. Because the FBI had jurisdiction over reservation deaths only if they were criminal in nature, and because even then the colonial police force tended not to be interested in Indian corpses, reporters thought it odd for even one agent, let alone four, to go to Amiot's. In later years, Zagrosi dismissed such talk as nonsense. He said that after two of his men were killed on the reservation in a shootout the year before, he dispatched agents to every unattended death to see if there might be a tie between the new corpse and the agent's killers. This was news to reporters. Whoever and however many of the agents at the scene were, what they saw was another story the FBI could not keep straight. The night the body was found, agents in Rapid City cabled Washington that there was no indication of foul play. But the same cable assigned the case the title Possible Manslaughter. There was no explanation how manslaughter had been suspected in the absence of evidence of foul play. The FBI would later say its agents were just suspicious about a dead body turning up in the middle of nowhere. But if this innocent explanation were true, agents should have retitled the case after Dr. Brown's autopsy concluded the woman had died innocently. But the possible manslaughter title continued to appear on documents from Rapid City even after Brown's autopsy, and still more incredibly, after Aquash's burial. The FBI would offer an explanation for this oddity, too. Its agents did not know about Brown's exposure finding until 8 days later. That is, the four agents who went to the autopsy were so uninterested in its outcome that neither then nor over the next week did they bother to ask what Jane Doe had died of. Only after the FBI learned that the dead and buried woman was Aquash did they ask what Dr. Brown had found. They asked by way of a chat on March 4th between Agent Wood and Dr. Brown. Agent Wood swore to all of this before the judge, who ordered Aquash exhumed. The only hitch in these claims is that an FBI cable released under the Freedom of Information Act says otherwise. The FBI knew of Brown's exposure finding at some unidentified point before Wood's chat with Brown on March 4th. No doubt, although the cable does not say as much, the FBI knew of the exposure finding the day Brown made it. Whenever, precisely, the FBI knew, the cable is at odds with Wood's sworn testimony and points to a cover-up. Wood may also have been attempting to cover up when he swore in court that Brown had told him in their chat that during his autopsy he had seen an obvious injury, a small contusion on the head. Brown, of course, said exactly the opposite in his autopsy report and on every other occasion that he was asked about the autopsy. It is impossible to sort out all the lies here, but probably Wood or Brown, knowing that when Aquash was exhumed and re-autopsied, the bullet would be found, decided it would look better if the authorities had seen a bump and missed a bullet than if they had missed everything, and thus concocted the obvious injury. The Dakota Press did not notice the many contradictions. The same newspapers that on February 25th had quoted FBI agents saying there was no hint of foul play, on March 4th, quoted Wood saying there had been a big hint of foul play. When, only a few weeks later, the FBI reversed course again, dropping Wood's claim of the obvious injury and resurrecting the original claim of no hint of violence, which has remained the official line ever since, the press, not having spotted the first change in course, did not spot the reversion. The agents who sent Aquash's hands to Washington were working in a long tradition. In four of the New World's 5 centuries, frontier capitals had paid bounties for native body parts in proof that their owners had been exterminated. As a grisly byproduct, scalps and hands, ears and genitals became trophies in the saloons and on the saddle horns of the Americas. Even in 1976, when Aquash was dismembered, the museums of civilized North America displayed the skeletons and mummified heads of tribal elders, grandparents and great-grandparents of those still living. The FBI agents who had Aquash's hands severed could not have known they were carrying on a tradition that would make a martyr of Aquash, that songs would be sung about her and ceremonies held in her honor, and newborns named for her decades after their deed. Agents did, however, know to be bashful about their handiwork. Early press releases said Aquash's fingerprints had been sent to Washington, but neglected to say that her fingers had gone with them. When the particulars were outed, the FBI described amputation as a standard practice for identification in many jurisdictions, but it could point to no such jurisdiction in North America. Over the years, the FBI refused to say whether its agents had considered other, less gruesome means of identification. It said only that it was impossible to obtain fingerprints on Pine Ridge. The claim did not sit right with Gary Peterson. All fingers, he wrote in his autopsy report, show distinct fingerprint ridges, although the finger pads appear somewhat wrinkled. Dr. Peterson said afterward that anyone trained in taking prints, that is, any FBI agent or BIA officer, should have been able to print the fingers. Had better results been wanted, the agents could have asked Dr. Brown to inject fluid beneath the dehydrated fingertips. If all else had failed, Brown could have severed only the fingertips, as the FBI lab eventually did, putting each tip in the corresponding finger of a latex glove and sending those to Washington. There was no justification for taking the entire hands. A naïf might read into the FBI's claims that it was impossible to obtain fingerprints, a suggestion that someone had tried. This was not so. The lawman who had gone to Dr. Brown's autopsy eventually said they were too afraid of destroying even a single print to gently daub a pinky with ink and press it to paper. Far safer, they thought, to have the hands sawn off, immersed in a formaldehyde-filled jar and mailed to Washington. That the lab could make casts of the prints even after 2,000 miles of jostling against glass, and that Dr. Peterson found the fingers still printable after their return to Pine Ridge, suggested something about their original state. One question, Ken Tilson later said, that the FBI could never answer about cutting off her hands was, why not wait? Tilson in latter years was a man of bare pate and bad angina, but still, as he had been in the 1970s, an adherent of the querulous detail, which he piled one atop the next with compounding weight. He carried himself accordingly, chest forward, like a stevedore or beauty queen, but the aggressive effect was tempered by a wrinkled, deliberate voice conveying lawyerly gravitas. Even if the FBI thought they had to cut off her hands, basic
sample complete. Ready to continue?